Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program, how best to interpret what Janet Yellen is going to say tomorrow. The airport economy as well, and Jim Fallows in our series American Futures. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 13th of November. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with tomorrow's news. The Senate Banking Committee and Dr. Janet Yellen, Ph.D. Economics, Yale, 1971. Yellen is President Obama's nominee to lead the Federal Reserve come next January when Ben Bernanke's term expires. Senators will, of course, be paying keen attention during the hearing, as will the markets, which is why you can bet Yellen will be practicing that fine Washington art of talking without really saying all that much. And in all that talking, you will hear about quantitative easing, transparency, tapering perhaps, and in the arcane parlance of monetary policy, maybe even a little something about hawks and doves. Marketplace's David Gura is where it's at.
The current Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, is what's known as a dove. His predecessor, Alan Greenspan, was dovish, but Paul Volcker, he was a hawk when he led the Fed from 1979 to 1987. Well, to find out the difference between hawks and doves, I went in search of a really rare bird.
Hi, I'm Donald Marin. I'm an economist and also a bird watcher.
Turns out the hawk and dove dichotomy has been around for decades.
Doves are the bird of peace, and, you know, hawks have talons and are, you know, the violent ones.
In monetary policy, hawks have a laser-like focus on inflation. Keeping that under control is one of the Fed's two mandates. And doves? Well, they're concerned with the other mandate. Paul Wachtel is an economist at NYU.
The dove, being a little bit softer, might be more concerned about what's going on in labor markets, the rate of growth, and the unemployment rate.
Wachtel says that today, with unemployment at 7.3%, doves are not happy. And hawks?
You know, there are not too many hawks out there nowadays.
That's because inflation right now is really low. Phil Swagel is a public policy professor at the University of Maryland.
The concern of a hawk today would be more that the Fed's easy monetary policy is distorting asset markets.
The Fed's been buying bonds to push interest rates down, and that's something that makes hawks skittish. David Blanchflower teaches economics at Dartmouth, and he says a good Fed policymaker, whether a hawk or a dove, focuses on the data and keeps an open mind.
When the economy gets back to normal and when we start to see a rise in inflation eventually, then the focus will have to move away from the employment part of the mandate to the inflation part of the mandate.
And actually, Janet Yellen is a great example of this. Now considered a dove, in the 90s, she was called a hawk. Blanchflower says the bird analogies don't stop here. When he was on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, Blanchflower was called an Uber dove.
People there actually classified a third type, which were people who sat on the fence in the middle and were called pigeons.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Kind of makes your brain hurt, doesn't it? A moment now for the performance review. You do a job, your boss decides how well you're doing it. But not all methods of reviewing performance are the same. Two big tech companies are getting some notice for something called stack ranking, a system that ranks workers against each other. At its most extreme, the employees at the bottom end of those rankings aren't employees very much longer. Microsoft used a system like this for years, but now says it's making a change, as Yahoo seems to be moving in the other direction, toward stack ranking. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
One way to gauge performance is to set goals and evaluate how well the employee matches up to them. But stack ranking compares workers against each other. Longtime GE CEO Jack Welch championed it.
For the first time, a corporate chieftain was going out and saying they would fire the bottom 10% and go out and try to hire better people.
That's management consultant Dick Grote. He's a former GE employee who wrote the book on what he calls forced ranking. He says it works because it forces managers to identify who's great and who needs help. But even supporters admit the system has a bad name.
Virtually no one uses that term forced ranking anymore. That carries so much negative baggage.
Critics believe it drives talent away and creates unhealthy competition, a kind of intercubicle hunger games. David Auerbach saw this when he managed Microsoft developers.
There was every incentive to try to backstab other people so that you would come out on top, because anyone's loss could be your gain.
Many current and former Microsoft workers say that system was the wrong way to go for a tech company, which requires teamwork to innovate. These evaluation systems aren't just about keeping an eye on workers. Companies also use them to make sure bosses do their jobs. Ed Lawler is a professor at USC's business school.
If every manager was a perfect manager, you wouldn't need a performance management system.
They aren't, of course, so performance reviews aren't going away. And despite some criticism, Stack Ranking doesn't appear to be either. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, up arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a massive effort to help the victims of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. That includes sending supplies, food and clothing, mostly. Turns out a lot of Filipinos living abroad do that anyhow, even in good times. And there is a well-established system of getting goods from here to there. From Chicago, WBEZ's Odette Youssef reports.
Every inch of Romy Arrieta's small apartment in Chicago is covered. There are stuffed animals and pots and pans crowding the kitchen. But some of it is headed out. Near the door are three big cardboard boxes. They're bound for Quezon City in the Philippines. Who are you sending these boxes to?
My sisters, my brothers. My sister's the one to distribute them to all my brothers and in-laws and nephews and nieces.
The boxes contain groceries, clothes, and other souvenirs from America. Arrieta sends them every couple of months, and they have a name, Balikbayan boxes. There's a whole industry devoted to their door-to-door delivery. Alpha Nicolasin remembers receiving boxes as a child in the Philippines.
In Filipino, we say it's Amoy America, meaning to say it smells like America because it smells like chocolates, smells like soap, or, you know, goodies that come from the States. So it has a certain smell to it.
Today, Nicolasin works for a Chicago-area company that ships Balikbayan boxes. It's called Serrera Express. The company sends about 1,000 boxes a month. The boxes take 4 to 6 weeks to arrive by sea, but people put up with that because it's cheap. By air, they'd cost hundreds of dollars to send. By sea, it's only around $75 per box. Now many of these Balikbayan companies are pitching in on typhoon relief. Nicolasin is soliciting donations that they'll ship for free.
They can bring it to our warehouse. We're putting together some boxes for shipment. Yeah. Non-perishable items, clothes, blankets, Pwede din toiletry like shampoo, soap.
Nicolasin says they'll ship out whatever they get next week. But there's a new challenge to getting the Balikbayan boxes where they're needed. The major port of Tacloban was destroyed by the typhoon. From Chicago, I'm Odette Youssef for Marketplace.
Iran is no stranger to economic sanctions. Some of them have been in place for decades now. But this past June, the Obama administration placed a new round of restrictions on an organization not generally known outside Iran. It's called Sittad, and it's one reason that the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, has been able to stay in power so long. Steve Stecklow is the co-author of an investigation that Reuters has been doing on that group. The investigation is titled Assets of the Ayatollah. Steve, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Kai.
This group, Sittad, which is, I guess, in translation called Headquarters for Executing the Order of the Imam. Where did it come from? How did it get started?
It was actually started by an order that was issued by the original supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, who 2 months before he died asked two aides of his to manage and sell properties that had been abandoned and to donate most of the proceeds to charity. As we found in our series, many of the properties weren't abandoned at all, but they had belonged to ordinary Iranians who had left the country for various reasons, just ordinary people who moved to places like Los Angeles and Europe and things like that.
What does Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader, do with this money? I mean, you say repeatedly in your investigation that he lives a very frugal lifestyle. He's got threadbare carpets in his apartments or in his house. So what's he doing? How is he using these assets to help bolster his control of that country?
Well, Kai, as you point out, we found no evidence that he personally enriches himself with this. However, money is power. One thing he does, according to people familiar with the matter, is that he uses it to rule the country. He's got at least 500 people working for him in Tehran itself.
Give me a sense of how big Sitad is in comparison to the Iranian economy.
It's very difficult to get a precise net worth because their accounts are secret. But we documented about roughly $95 billion worth, which exceeds the value of the oil that was exported in the most recent year that statistics are available. Now, again, I think it's the sort of vast scope of this. Basically, they have stakes in every sector of the Iranian economy, including the energy sector, banking, construction companies. They have a charity division as well that has invested in the pharmaceutical industry. So I think this is a matter of explaining why Khamenei has been so successful in maintaining power over such a long period of time. It's now been 24 years.
Steve Stecklow is an investigative reporter for Reuters. He is based in London, which is where he talked to him about his series that's on Reuters right now. It's called Assets of the Ayatollah. Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
the way people understand their past and the things that worked affects their view of the present and, more importantly, the future.
Jim Fallows, American Futures and the Economic Narrative. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrials hiked 70 points today, 70 points, 0.4%, 15,821. The Nasdaq nudged up 45 points, 1.1%, ended things at 3965. The S&P 500 lifted 12 points, 0.75%, closed at 1780. Starbucks frothed up 1% today, even though a judge awarded damages against the company in a dispute with Kraft Foods. Kraft popped up 0.9%. Macy's led retailers higher, parading up, not get it, parading up 9% after its earnings report showed higher than expected sales. JCPenney stitched up 3%. The Gap stepped up 1.2% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.73%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. The Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in September. And did you know that 2013 is the International Year of Statistics? A symposium at the Bureau of Labor Statistics focuses on federal statistical agencies and careers in that field. It wraps tomorrow, but you have the rest of the year to count stuff. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The big news today from the world of medicine, non-Obamacare division, is cholesterol, specifically the drugs called statins that a lot of people take, millions of people really, take to lower theirs. The American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology are out with some new guidelines that could mean a big boost in the number of Americans taking statins. Thing is, a lot of statins are generics. That is not patent protected. So we asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to figure out how much money there might be to be made.
You've probably seen the ads for the brand name statins.
When diet and exercise are not enough, adding Lipitor may help.
The companies that make the generic drugs don't advertise, but they're still competing for business.
There are certainly some generic statins which are very effective that are being sold only as generics right now.
Vivian Ho is a health economist at Rice University. She says the market for generic drugs is profitable enough to attract some of the same companies that make the name brands.
The brand name drug makers produce those because they realize that there are some customers who are only going to purchase generics, and so they compete in that market as well.
Economics professor Fiona Scott Morton follows the pharmaceutical industry at the Yale School of Management. If more people take statins, she says some generic drug makers will see a short-term bump.
The generic drug companies will benefit because they'll sell more products. However, one of the really amazing features of the generic drug industry is how much competition there is, how much price competition in particular.
Your local pharmacy plays a big role here, too. There may be 10 or 15 versions of a generic drug, but the pharmacy only needs to stock one. That gives the pharmacy a role in determining which generic drug makers succeed.
The pharmacy will talk to different wholesalers and manufacturers and see what the best deal is that it can get.
In the long run, Morton says that competition will keep a lid on generic drug prices. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
About a year ago, a group connected to Occupy Wall Street started buying up people's personal debt and making it go away, forgiving it, technically. Almost $15 million worth so far disappeared in the little-known business of buying bad debt. Kate Davidson explains.
When you've got debt, there are basically two kinds of letters you can get. One that says, pay us, or one from Andrew Ross and his fellow members of the Strike Debt Group.
What we do is we go in and we buy the debt, and instead of collecting on it, we abolish it. And we write to the people who are involved, the debtors, and we tell them they're off the hook.
Ross says that $15 million worth of mostly medical debt only cost about $400,000 to buy. That's because debt collection has changed dramatically. Creditors, like your credit card company, used to just collect from you or pay someone else to do it. Now, Laura Udis of the Consumer Federation of America says they sell your bad debts to third-party debt buyers.
And in those cases, there is no continuing business relationship between the creditor and the consumer. And that changes the entire debt collection picture.
Debt buyers purchase seemingly uncollectible debt for an average of 4 cents on the dollar. They make money by coming after you for the full amount. The Federal Trade Commission recently studied 9 of the 10 biggest debt buyers. Christopher Cagle is with the FTC.
Those accounts had a face value of $143 billion. The debt buyers that we studied spent about $6.5 billion to acquire them.
That's a pretty good profit margin if they collect the full amount. Andrew Ross of Occupy Wall Street says he wants people to know they can negotiate with debt buyers when they get that call or that letter in the mail. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Imagine a captive audience, a captive customer base, really, that numbers in the many, many millions. We bring you now the business of airport businesses. The busy U.S. hubs generated $5 billion in sales last year, and there is no place busier than Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport with 90 million passengers a year. Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta explains what it takes to open up shop.
Believe it or not, there is no place to get a haircut in the world's busiest airport. But that's about to change. But
Jim, kind of what we're looking at right now, and it's very, you know, it doesn't look like much, but you see where this little wall is?
Airport manager Lewis Miller and I stand in the main atrium. He points to a tiny patch of drywall. Just by looking, you'd never know a business is about to go in here.
There'll be a sign that'll go up there that'll tell people it's a barbershop. And there'll be the red and white barber poles that you see sitting around.
This future barbershop needs some work. Wires hang where a suspended ceiling used to be. A non-working soda cooler is covered in dust. But Miller sees this space as a potential gold mine.
I think it's very lucrative, just the number of people that are coming through every single day.
For this space, airport officials want something distinctive, a flavor that says Atlanta. Originally, the airport issued a formal request for proposals. Not a single barber applied. Airport managers regrouped, decided to go door-to-door. That got more interest, including from 40-year-old Herbert Williams.
Supply and demand is, you know, one of the things we're looking at, and if there's a demand for it, we are ready to supply it.
For a decade, Williams has owned Vintage, the barber shop in downtown Atlanta. The chairs are 1948 Koken Presidents. A vending machine dispenses Coca-Cola in glass bottles. Williams wouldn't say much about his barbershop proposal, but it works the same as every business at every major U.S. airport. There's rent, significantly more than what he's paying here. He must, no matter what, pay the airport for the privilege of operating there. The minimum at Hartsfield-Jackson is $25,000 a year. And for every cut he does, the airport gets a cut.
Does it frighten me? No. Because, you know, the airport has been very successful when it comes to businesses being an airport.
There's the potential to make a significant amount of money in an airport environment versus on a street location.
Kenneth Buchanan is with Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. He says the airport put its first barber in more than 20 years ago.
The time-pressed traveler gravitated to those types of amenities.
Now there are 8 hair shops, he says, and all are doing well, sharing in the airport's $300 million annual concessions revenue. With numbers like that, vintage owner Herbert Williams knows his proposal has to, in his words, make sense. Williams figures if it does, he'll make 3 times the profit he brings in at his downtown location.
May the best man win. Yeah.
Proposals are due in next week, with world's busiest barbershop set to open in about a year. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
One plane, 4 seats, 1 engine, landing where you want, when you want, then getting out and looking around. That, in a nutshell, is the series we're doing with Jim Fallows and his wife Deb that we're calling American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, got Tango for landing.
Part of what we've seen, Jim, Deb, and I, in the past couple of places we've been, is that the towns that are doing well are doing well in part because they're building a specific story, a story about the kind of town they are, the kind of town they want to be. And that often turns out to be a story that changes their economic fortunes. Jim, it's good to talk to you. Welcome back.
Kai, thank you.
Give me a for instance, Jim, would you, of this idea of narrative and destiny, I guess?
Let me click off a couple of them quickly. There's a little town of Holland, Michigan, on the shore of Lake Michigan, which has a long manufacturing heritage, but recently their downtown was running down. The way they turned that in a different direction was to have this oddball plan of heating all the city streets and sidewalks so there was never snow on them. The lesson the city people drew from that is that local manufacturers, local wealthy people could turn their attention to local problems and solve it. In Sioux Falls, as we discussed before, they had a change in legislation that allowed them to attract new kinds of businesses. In Burlington, Vermont, there was a real renaissance of the downtown, which people say, yes, we did that one time, we can do it again. The point that I think rises above the specifics is that the way people understand their past and the things that worked affects their view of the present and, more importantly, the future.
Who has to believe, though, Jim? I mean, so let's go back to Eastport. The guy we talked to at the port, Chris Gardner, who told the stories about the pregnant cows and all of that, he clearly believes. But does everybody in town have to be on board, or is it enough for one person? Is it enough for the town mothers and fathers to lead the way and hope everybody follows in absorbing the narrative?
Of course, that's a crucial and complicated question, because, you know, one of the many unscientific aspects of what we're doing as we travel around is we only see the people who've decided to stay someplace. Mm-hmm. You know, the population of Eastport has fallen by, you know, 3/4 over the last half century. The people who are still there have to think it's worth it and there are ways they can work together. I think the people who feel otherwise, they've gone other places.
Well, along those lines, let me ask you the drinking the Kool-Aid test. What's the risk of everybody believing it so much that it can't possibly come true because it's not realistic?
This is a question people have asked about the U.S. in general, mm-hmm, almost since the time of our founding, whether the prevailing ideal we have here, that people are in charge of their own destinies, from, you know, Benjamin Franklin or Horatio Alger or any other great either idealizer or mythmaker, if you will, of American life, whether that runs the risk of lulling people into blaming themselves for situations beyond their control. You know, there are economic ups and downs that nobody can do anything about. I think at the local level, the danger would be people trying too hard to hang on to something that's just not savable.
Do you think this applies at the national level? I mean, it's one thing for Eastport population 1,330, whatever it was, to believe in this, and even Holland, Michigan, a lovely town, I'm sure. But at the national level, can we, through force of narrative, retrieve things that we need to in this country?
I actually think we can. Like you, I've spent a fair amount of my life outside the United States watching it from outside. And what is so impressive to me is both the collective national mythos and sort of the component parts that make us different from other places. One of the most important parts of those components is the idea that we can suck in people, attract talent from all around the world and give them a chance. That's a lot harder for other places to do. And I think that the idea of America always having some ideal of what it can aspire to, I think it does give us some power.
And that's why we call the series American Futures. James Fallows, he is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. We'll be off at some point in December again, Jim, I guess, yes?
Yes, we're going to see you on the West Coast.
Oh,
and
excellent.
Details
Good.
To come.
All right, it'll be warmer. Jim, take care. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, Kai.
The whole series, audio, videos, and Jim's blog from The Atlantic is online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, following up to our story from yesterday about the Affordable Care Act and enrollment. The official figures came out this afternoon from the Department of Health and Human Services. The breakdown goes like this. Almost 27,000 people signed up through healthcare.gov. That's the federal government's troubled website. Another 79,000 or so enrolled through state exchanges. The actual precise number is 106,185 people who've chosen an insurance policy through Obamacare. Thanks to Ben White at Politico for this bit of context on that. Capacity at Michigan Stadium in Ann Arbor, the big house, is 109,901. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brandon Willard, and Randy Wine. Engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.